This is Morgan Michael, welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness, together by challenging our assumptions and venturing beyond the status quo in education. We can make a big impact, one small act at a time.
We should be treating these kids with every bit as much compassion as we would any other learning disability. And we should be figuring out what's getting in their way every bit as much as we do with any other learning disability. Is that if you work in a school, you've got that kid 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, 9 months a year. And you can do that kid a whole lot of good in 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, 9 months a year, even if he's going home to something that isn't exactly ideal. And in fact, I would say that it's the kid who's going home to something that isn't exactly ideal who needs us to be on our game the most.
If you are an educator, school administrator, parent, camp counselor, or employer, chances are you've had experience with challenging behaviors. So often we focus on crisis management and behavior modification to attempt to make challenging behaviors go away. But as we know, sticker charts and reward systems do little to encourage intrinsic motivation and furthermore do not address the underlying problems that cause the problematic behaviors. I sat down with Dr. Ross Green this summer to discuss his collaborative and proactive solutions model in order to learn how we can solve some of the most challenging school behaviors. Here are some of the things we discussed: his four main philosophies that guide the CPS model, the three main umbrella lagging skills, which give you a really good jump-off point in terms of how to solve some of these tricky problems, inclusion and how it fits into the CPS model, the most important skills for an educator to lead with, and a step-by-step framework to implement CPS, as well as a real-world example of CPS in action. This is an action-packed episode for you. I know that you'll learn something. I know I did. You can find out more about Dr. Ross Green on livesinthebalance.org, thekidswelose.com, cpsconnection.com. You can read in-depth all about his philosophy and some of his methods through several of his books, including The Explosive Child, Lost at School, and Raising Human Beings. Dr. Ross Green, I just want to thank you so much for coming on Kindsight 101 today. It's a pleasure to have you.
It's my pleasure to be talking with you.
Perhaps some of my audience members have not heard of CPS and what it is. And so I'd love for you to sort of talk about what are the four main philosophies that guide your practice in the collaborative and proactive solutions with children exhibiting those challenging behaviors. Can we start with that kids do well if they can philosophy?
Sure. And just to let people know, CPS stands for Collaborative and Proactive Solutions. Kids do well if they can is the belief that if this kid could do well, he or she would do well. And that if he or she is not doing well, something must be getting in his or her way. And lack of motivation is not what's getting in his or her way. What the research is telling us is getting in his or her way is lagging skills. And we also know that those lagging skills are especially problematic in the conditions in which they are being demanded. And we call those conditions unsolved problems. And so what we're focused on in this model is the fact that kids are not doing poorly because they're getting their jollies that way. They're not doing poorly because it's working for them. They're doing poorly because they're lacking the skills to do better. And if we work with them to solve the problems that are causing their challenging behavior, then not only will the problems get solved, not only will the behaviors improve, but the skills that they are lacking will get taught. So it's what I call a 3-for-1 sale. But all that flows from the mantra, kids do well if they can.
And so you also talk about the fact that our explanation guides our intervention. So when we're coming from a generous standpoint of kids can do well if they can, that our response would often be more of a side-by-side collaborative partner as opposed to a top-down punitive authoritarian. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. If you think a kid isn't doing well because he doesn't want to, then you think the main role for you to play in the life of that kid is to make him want to do well. And I think we adults, parents and educators alike, spend way too much of our time trying to make kids want to do well. The way that's usually done is by rewarding the behaviors we like so as to see more of them, and punishing the behaviors we don't like so as to see less of them. Unfortunately, that's a lot of what people still do here in the year 2019. But when you believe that a kid who's having difficulty is having difficulty because there are problems that they are having difficulty solving on their own, and when we help them solve those problems, and when we do it collaboratively with the kid, not to him, and proactively rather than reactively in the heat of the moment, things do tend to get a whole lot better.
I thought it was so interesting hearing from you that it's important not to treat kids the same. I think sometimes we have this perspective about equity, and maybe in the educational community, like we don't want to mislead the other fence sitters in our class, you might say. So the ones who are watching to see what your response is to a particularly difficult or challenging situation with the student. However, you say we have to be responsible to the hand that we've been dealt. So it's not really effective to be treating kids the same or to have this expectation that our response to children will be the same. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, I'm always fascinated by the belief that in a school classroom, you could treat everybody exactly the same. Mm-hmm. I know that high stakes testing sometimes pushes people in that direction. But the reason there's something called differentiated instruction, the reason there's something called personalized learning, the reason there's special education law is because we don't treat everybody exactly the same. And by the way, I don't think it's just the fence sitters who are watching. They're all watching. Mm-hmm. And if we continue to treat kids in ways that are ineffective, we lose credibility with all of them. You pick up credibility with kids when you make sure that they are clear about the fact that fair does not mean equal, and that they are clear that fair does not mean equal benefits each individual kid, not just the ones with behavioral challenges. So, you know, where this idea that you treat everybody exactly the same came from, I have no idea. It's just impossible to do in a school classroom.
Yes, I'd agree. And I wonder if it's part of that industrial model that we're, you know, that idea that you basically put the kids in the input and then they go through the system and then they're supposed to come out a certain way. And we know that that is definitely failing. And that's been a common theme on this podcast, is just deconstructing the myth that that industrial model of education actually works.
Well, it's a total myth that you can treat everybody exactly the same. I think that standards are an okay thing. I think that having goals for each grade level and what we're going to accomplish within a given school year, I don't have a huge problem with that. But beyond that, it all comes down to individualizing, and that's where differentiated instruction comes from. It sounds like we agree on that.
I think so. Can you talk to the three umbrella skills that a child needs for that social and emotional regulation? I know you talk about flexibility and adaptability, that frustration tolerance, and the problem solving. I'd love to hear a little bit more about that and maybe describe those a little bit for us.
Sure. Well, what that refers to in a very rough way is the fact that what the research has been telling us about behaviorally challenging kids for a very long time is that they're lacking skills. In the research, literally hundreds of skills have been identified that could be found lacking in any kid with behavioral challenges. The summary skills that I use to summarize all of the skills that the research tells us they could be lacking are flexibility, adaptability, frustration tolerance, and problem solving. And what's also important to realize is that it's when those skills are being demanded that kids with behavioral challenges look behaviorally challenging. Otherwise, they actually look pretty good. But in conditions in which flexibility, adaptability, frustration tolerance, and problem solving are being demanded, that's when they look bad. And here's the good news. That actually means that the conditions under which they are likely to run into difficulty are highly predictable. And if those conditions are highly predictable, then 99.9% of our intervention efforts can be proactive. And the reason that's important is because intervening in the heat of the moment, when a highly predictable unsolved problem has set in motion a challenging episode yet again, not only makes no sense, not only is counterproductive, but it's unnecessary. If we are figuring out what a kid's lagging skills and unsolved problems are proactively, I don't want to minimize the importance of those skills. There's actually over 100 skills that the research tells us behaviorally challenging kids could be lacking. But those skills that you mentioned, flexibility, adaptability, frustration, tolerance, and problem solving, are a good intro for people who weren't even aware that behaviorally challenging kids might be lacking skills.
If we were to reframe how we look at these challenging kids with some of those challenging behaviors, and we were to look at that as an actual learning disability, that again, when it comes back to changing our explanation, the whole framework changes. We look at this through the lens of how can we support them in that learning disability when it comes to the social and emotional supports that we and scaffolding that we provide them. Would you agree with that?
Totally. And I've often referred to behavioral challenges as a learning disability because that's what the research tells us about behaviorally challenging kids. They're lacking skills. And so I don't really view this learning disability as any different than any other learning disability. We should be treating these kids with every bit as much compassion as we would any other learning disability. And we should be figuring out what's getting in their way every bit as much as we do with any other learning disability.
Mm-hmm. And before we do dive into kind of the nuts and bolts of the process and the framework, I want to talk about the spectrum of maladaptive behaviors. Mm. And you said that they're caused by often the same reasons in many different kids, but expressed differently. So for example, you said that, you know, on the easiest level of the spectrum, we have, you know, the sulking and the whining, which we see in many typical kids. And then the medium, which is sort of that screaming or swearing or even throwing things. We see those kids at home. We see those kids in the classroom sometimes when they're really agitated. And then of course in the extreme, so they're hurting themselves, they're hurting others, or it can be as extreme as taking someone's life or even their own. And I found it so interesting that you said the wrong interventions can actually push someone along further in that spectrum in the extreme direction. Can you talk to that a little bit as well?
Well, these days I've been, you know, one of the things I've always said is that it's not especially helpful to slice the pie by what behaviors a kid is exhibiting to communicate that he or she is having difficulty meeting expectations. That's what psychiatric disorders do. But that doesn't mean it's actually the most useful way to look at things. These days, I just refer to the behaviors that kids exhibit to communicate that they're having difficulty meeting expectations as either lucky or unlucky. Lucky are some of the ones you mentioned, whining, pouting, sulking, withdrawing, crying. Unlucky are things like hitting, spitting, swearing, screaming, throwing, destroying, running. But what the field of developmental psychopathology tells us is that whether a kid is communicating that he or she is having difficulty meeting expectations in ways that are lucky or unlucky, the behavior is communicating the exact same thing. I'm stuck. There are expectations I'm having difficulty meeting. But what we do to kids who are communicating that they're having difficulty meeting expectations in ways that are unlucky is not only counterproductive, but often unconscionable. There's absolutely no reason to think that a detention, suspension, expulsion, paddling, restraining, secluding, no reason to think that any of those interventions are going to solve the problems that are causing the behaviors that are causing us to do those things in the first place. So this is what we get, by the way, by being primarily focused on behavior, which is just the signal, and being primarily focused on what we're doing in the heat of the moment. And that puts us in crisis management mode. The whole gist of the collaborative and proactive solutions approach is on that middle word of the model, proactive. When we are being proactive, we are identifying lagging skills and unsolved problems ahead of time. We are solving those problems proactively. We are dramatically reducing challenging behavior by not focusing primarily on the challenging behavior. It really does turn a lot of things around in a big way. I'm sorry to report that this is not what most school discipline programs are oriented toward still, but it is what they should be oriented toward.
Right. And actually, I want to jump off from some of those words that you used. You talked about paddling, you talked about school suspensions, you talked about seclusion and restraint methods as well. In the US, obedience continues to be the main driver in many school districts. And in the documentary that you are affiliated with, Kids We Lose, there are some significant and shocking stats about the punitive measures being used. So 5.4 million students are suspended. I think it's every year. Is that correct? And then 300,000 students are referred to law enforcement or are arrested for their behavior, minors. And then tens of thousands. Now, this was really, really disturbing to me, are paddled in places like Arkansas and South Carolina. How have things gotten this bad? I think for a lot of us, this just seems shocking and unbelievable.
I think things have always been pretty bad. I think that we are finally shining a light on it. And if any of your listeners are not familiar with the recently released documentary film, The Kids We Lose, it was produced by Lives in the Balance and Lone Wolf Media. Lives in the Balance is my nonprofit. And the whole goal of the film was to shine a light on these horrific and unnecessary and counterproductive things that we do to kids by mere virtue of the fact that they are communicating that they're having difficulty meeting expectations in ways that are unlucky. It is truly unconscionable here in the year 2019 that we still do this stuff. How did it get to be this way? I'm not exactly sure. I know what needs to be done about it. That I'm sure about.
When I look at your framework, definitely it is a roadmap that enables us to rethink the whole paradigm of punishment in schools, really. Before we jump to that, I just want to talk about this idea of judgment, because I think when I perceive your framework, there's an element of non-judgment within it. This idea that nobody's bad, nobody's the bad guy, there's no blaming or finger pointing, it just is what it is, and how do we move forward? And so you've talked about the fact that conventional wisdom says that kids come to be challenging because of inconsistent or ineffective or passive parenting styles through which that child has learned that challenging behavior is an effective way to get what they want or what they need, maybe attention or something else. And so what would you say to a parent who has a child who has exhibited or is exhibiting difficult behaviors, and to sort of take that shame away? Because I think there's an element of shame in all of this. Would you agree?
I do. I think we've been blaming parents for the challenging behavior of their kids for a very long time. I stopped doing that when I noticed that the vast majority of parents I was working with who had one behaviorally child in their family also had other children in their family who were well-behaved. Mm. And that's a good thing, by the way, to notice, because it says to you, there must be something else going on here. Maybe this isn't passive, permissive, inconsistent, non-contingent, inept, neglectful parenting. Now, I know that some people are probably rolling their eyes at the moment because they're thinking, yeah, but there are parents out there who are not great. Yeah, that's right. But they also often have very well-behaved kids in their home. And the reality is, in schools, there are many, many well-behaved kids who are behaviorally challenging at home. So in schools, they don't even know half the picture mm-hmm. of what could be. If the research is correct, and it's pretty compelling at this point, it's been out there for a long time, and this is about lagging skills, then we've been blaming parents incorrectly. We've missed the boat on the skills part. And boy, we could have been so helpful all along if we hadn't have been so busy looking outside the school for the cause of a kid's challenging behavior. Now, once again, no one knows better than I do that there are some kids who are going home to situations that are not even remotely ideal. I get that. But what I also get is that if you work in a school, you've got that kid 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, 9 months a year. And you can do that kid a whole lot of good in 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, 9 months a year, even if he's going home to something that isn't exactly ideal. And in fact, I would say that it's the kid who's going home to something that isn't exactly ideal who needs us to be on our game the most. But we are not going to, we're going to just distract ourselves if all we're thinking about with this behaviorally challenging student is what he's going home to. You may not be able to do much about what he's going home to, but you can definitely do something about what those 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, 9 months a year looks like while that kid's in your classroom.
Yes. I had a friend who wanted me to ask a question related to this, and I'd love to jump in here and ask that. What is your take on school-family partnership? What do you say about the research coming out about the importance of creating that school-to-family relationship and that connection?
Well, I think that it's absolute nirvana when a school is doing so well by a kid that they can also invite parents in to see what they're doing and to collaborate with the parents as well. The truth is, good to collaborate with parents right from the word go. Yes, there are going to be parents who are not so enthusiastic about participating in that. Now we've still got to go back to, we've got the kid 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, 9 months out of the year. But CPS is very much a take a look at yourself model. And one of the things I do think we need to do, I get it, parents can sometimes not be so easy to work with. But I think we need to take a look at ourselves and see and try to think about, have we made it possible or harder for parents to work with us? Are we somehow communicating to parents that we are blaming them for the expectations their child is having difficulty meeting on our watch? We certainly shouldn't be. Are these parents who feel the eyes in the entire school are on them when they walk into the building as the parents of that kid? So, you know, this is also a put yourself in the other person's shoes model. I try to put myself in the shoes of parents who feel that way. I try to put myself in the shoes of educators who are feeling completely overwhelmed, feel like they're barely keeping their head above water given what's coming into their classroom these days. Plenty of empathy to go around. Better for us not to turn on each other. Better for us to work with each other. There's a wonderful book that I often recommend by Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot called The Essential Conversation. It should be required reading for every educator and every parent who's got a kid in school, because it talks about how difficult it is. Even though we're sharing the same kid, even though we both have expertise on the same kid, how difficult it is for parents and teachers to talk to each other sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I will definitely be putting that in the show notes for people to get their hands on it. All right. I want to dive into the meat of the CPS framework. I know that it's based on the difference. It's very different from the behavior-based modification programs. So there's problem solving as opposed to that behavior modification. You really advocate for collaboration versus that unilateral decision-making from the top. And it's proactive, not reactive. Can you take us through those three main steps of the CPS framework?
Absolutely. There's three steps that are involved in solving a problem collaboratively. And once again, it is best to think of this as being done proactively. While these three steps can be used emergently, no model is at its best emergently, except crisis management models, which, quite frankly, don't solve any problems. They just de-escalate kids or, worse yet, cause us to lay hands on them when we feel that they're becoming unsafe and our de-escalation efforts have failed. But there are three steps that are involved in solving a problem collaboratively. They are called the empathy step, the define adult concern step, and the invitation step. As I always say, the names of the steps don't matter so much. The ingredients of the steps matter a great deal. The main ingredient of the empathy step is information gathering. This is where we're gathering information from the student, the child, on what's making it hard for the child to meet a particular expectation, whether that's difficulty completing the double-digit division problems on the worksheet in math, or difficulty sitting next to Teresa during circle time, or difficulty completing the term paper in English. We need to find out what's making it hard for the kid to meet that expectation. And this is one of the hardest parts of the model. Your number one source of information on that is the kid, mm-hmm. not the caregiver. As I'm always telling people, it's not your job to know what's getting in the kid's way. It's your job to know how to find out. And that's what's going on in the empathy step. The define adult concern step is where the adult is entering his or her concern into consideration, mostly about why they feel it's important for the kid to meet that expectation. Adult concerns usually fall into one or both of two categories: how the unsolved problem is affecting the kid, how the unsolved problem is affecting other people. And then in the invitation, child and caregiver are working together, collaborating on a solution. But a solution that must meet two criteria. This is the definition of a good solution, by the way, for all of us. It's got to be realistic, meaning both parties can truly do what they're agreeing to do. It's got to be mutually satisfactory, meaning the solution truly addresses the concerns of both parties. Here's what I've been saying a lot lately, and world history bears me out on this, not just my work with over 2,000 unlucky kids. If the solution is not realistic and mutually satisfactory, I promise you, this problem is still unsolved.
I'm sure you have so many examples. I mean, you've written a ton on this, books, and you've done many radio shows about this. Is there an example that could take us through this model and exemplify some of the language that you would use? Is that possible?
Oh, there's gazillions, but let me see if I can think of one.
Sure.
There's one that I have a great video of that I show at many of my workshops of a fourth grader named Anthony, who was having difficulty staying in the general ed classroom for most of his classes. In the empathy step, we learned, I should tell you what the solution was before anyone collaborated with him on a solution. The solution that the adults came up with was to reward him for staying in the general ed classroom and basically punish him when he didn't. In the empathy step, we learned from Anthony that the general ed classroom was too noisy and too crowded. And by the way, as always, that's something a reward and punishment program would never address. Not a sticker, not a detention, not a suspension, not an expulsion, not a paddling, not a restraint, not a seclusion. None of those interventions are going to help Anthony with the fact that the general ed classroom is too noisy and too crowded. Mm-hmm. The adult's concern was that while he was allowed to go to the resource room whenever he wanted, he was spending the entire day there, and that was not the plan. And that the reason that they were rewarding him for staying in the general ed classroom is that they were hoping he would get more excited. Now, the first thing to notice when we finally talked to Anthony about this, unexcited was not what his concern was. It was that it was too noisy and too crowded. But this is something we adults frequently do. We come up with solutions based on our assumptions about what's getting in the kid's way, without asking the kid. This is the beauty of this model, by the way. The kid is a full participant in helping us understand what's making it hard for him to meet this expectation and coming up with solutions that are going to work with both parties. And interestingly enough, why not? In the invitation, Anthony's solution. He was going to stay in the resource room, especially for the classes that were especially too noisy and too crowded. And that was math and meeting time and one other time in the day. but that Anthony felt that he'd be perfectly fine staying in the general ed classroom for several other classes. And that it, though they were noisy and crowded, he'd be able to stay in the general ed classroom for those, so long as he wasn't in the general ed classroom for the classes that were the most noisy and the most crowded. All right, so we heard Anthony's concerns. We heard the adults' concerns. They wanted to make sure that Anthony learned everything that he was supposed to be learning in the general ed classroom. Mm-hmm. And then we came up with a solution that would address the concerns of both parties.
Powerful. I want to talk to you, actually, because this made me think about the concept of inclusion. And again, back to everybody needs to have the same experience. It seems as though inclusion is a real buzzword right now, and I understand the theory behind it. But there's a part of me as an educator that knows, that has heard from students very similar things to what Anthony has articulated in your story, that sometimes that general classroom, which is collaborative and busy and boisterous and people are ping-ponging ideas, that can be tremendously overwhelming for somebody who may later classify themselves as an introvert or enjoy having that quiet time to let ideas percolate. What is your take on the idea of having this goal of push in? Everybody needs to be in that general classroom at all times. What's your take on that?
Well, number one, my take is that there are some kids who that's just not going to fly with. Mm-hmm. But I think it would fly with most if, you know, as I said in the film, what we did with inclusion is we included kids who had historically not been included. And this goes way back.
Yes.
And that's a great philosophy. I'm all over it. I think it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. On condition, and that is that we prepare classroom teachers for what's coming. If we don't prepare classroom for teachers for what's coming, then inclusion is going to be a really rough slog. You have somebody who may not understand what's walking in the classroom, may not understand what each kid needs. This is why I love differentiated instruction, why I love personalized learning, because those give us sort of a template for how to individualize. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what a lot of, well, I've seen some classroom teachers who are just incredible at it. I also think that with each new initiative in schools, some kid is going to have trouble with it. When it was back in the days of sit still, listen to the teacher, be quiet until you're spoken to, you know, we lost a lot of kids. That's when ADHD became very popularized, because those were the kids who couldn't sit still and couldn't just listen, right? Mm-hmm. Now we have classrooms that are much more active, much busier, much more interaction. Who might we lose under those conditions? Kids who are not very good at that interaction, kids who find classrooms to be too noisy and find the relative lack of structure to be not exactly what they need. Bottom line is, no matter how you teach a classroom, there are going to be kids who are having difficulty with it. In the parlance of this model, that's known as an unsolved problem. Mm-hmm. In the spirit of this model, what we need to do with each of those kids is figure out what's making it hard for them to succeed in certain specific conditions and collaborate on solutions so that they can succeed.
Right. And I had a student like that who, during writing time, he just needed basically all of the stimuli to be gone. And he was able to articulate that. And we had a system where he had a timer that he would set himself, because he really liked the end caps of having a defined time period to do his work in. And he would do that. He identified that. And then he liked the headphones, and he liked being just outside of the classroom door where the door was open. He could see us, but he just needed that quiet space to do his pre-thinking for writing. And I thought, that's pretty good. I mean, I think of a lot of writers, I think you need that quiet space to let those ideas generate, right? And so I wonder, like, would you say that that's an example of solving that unsolved problem for a kid like that?
Absolutely. And, you know, now the big question, what's the downside in meeting the kid where he's at? What is the downside? We spend so much time on kids in classrooms when they're acting up because we haven't been responsive to what they actually need or we've decided that everybody has to look exactly the same, or we've decided that we already know what's getting in the kid's way and we'll just slap on a solution because we really know what we're doing. We've been trained, right? The amount of time that it takes to collaborate with kids on solutions to the problems that are making it difficult for them to meet expectations in our classrooms doesn't come close to the amount of time we spend on challenging behavior when we don't do that.
Right. Yeah, that's powerful. I want to talk a little bit about, a friend brought this up too. She said, what about when the peer orientation affects plan B? So when the expectations are actually a peer's expectations, not a teacher and not a parent. So what about a child? Say, for example, you know, when a teenager kind of focuses their interests more on their peers than their parents, or meeting the expectations that a parent might set. When they want to do well in the eyes of their peers, and obviously there can be some difficulties associated with that, what would you say to that?
I would say that if a kid is doing something with his peers that caregivers are not okay with, then we still have parental expectations coming into play. We would hear about why the kid is doing the things he or she is doing in the empathy step of plan of solving the problem. And we might hear about peer pressure in there, or we might hear that this is what my peers are doing. That really doesn't change the process at all. We are identifying problems based on what adult expectations are. Actually, the part that gets even more interesting is when the kid is having difficulty meeting an expectation of his or her own.
Right.
But if the kid is simply having difficulty meeting expectations of a peer, and that, you know, if that's not in violation of parental expectations, then it's no big deal, right? Like if peers are thinking, I think you should be the best swimmer in town,
sure,
and the kid's striving for that, and it's a realistic goal, then that would be perfectly in line with parental expectations. No big deal.
Right.
But if a kid is hanging out with peers and failing school, and because peers expect the kid to engage in maladaptive practices, now we do have a violation of a parental expectation, and now we do have a problem to solve.
Right. And I guess the same thing would go if a student, I mean, it may not even be as destructive as skipping school or not doing well, but even just kind of compromising their own integrity for a peer's expectation, if that makes sense,
yep,
that it can be a lot more subtle, but that they can kind of lose themselves in that as well. But I guess it's the same thing, that as a parent, the expectation would be, I'd love it if you still had, or your decisions were still based on what's important to you or your own value system. That's still the expectation.
Right.
Okay, that makes sense. That's great. Is there anything that you want to add before we jump into those rapid fire questions?
I just want people to know that there is an absolute treasure trove of free resources on this model that they've just heard a little bit about on the Lives in the Balance website. That's my nonprofit, livesinthebalance.org, that will take them way beyond what we've been talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
Just a ton of free resources waiting for people.
Fantastic. And I will also be sure to link that in the show notes so that people can do some digging on their own. What does kindness mean to you?
Listening.
And what one skill or superpower does an educator need to lead with in order to be effective?
Empathy.
And finally, if you could pick one quote that would be printed on one of those quote cups that could be sold in big bookstores around the world, what would it be?
There's a quote from a judge in Canada that goes something like this: I hope that someday we will learn the terrible cost we all pay when we ignore or mismanage those people in society who most need our help.
Mm. I think that's a really great way to finish this conversation. Thank you, Dr. Ross Green, so much for jumping on and joining me on Kindsight 101 today. It was really informative and just a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Wonderful talking with you.
I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes, and leave a review. Thank you so much. This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating a kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gain from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag smallactbigimpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.